You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This network is supported by our listeners. You can become a supporting member by going to archpodnet.com/members and signing up. As a supporting member, you have access to high-quality downloads of each show and a discount at our future online store and access to show hosts on a members-only Slack team. For professional members, we'll have training shows and other special content offered throughout the year. Once again, go to archpodnet.com/members to support the network and get some great extras and swag in the process. That's archpodnet.com/members.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, episode 19. I'm Chris Webster.
And I'm April Camp Whitaker. On today's show, we talk to Andrew Reinhard about archaeogaming, what it is, and what sort of research is currently underway.
Let's dig a little deeper. All right, everybody, welcome to the show. As we mentioned, we have Andrew Reinhard on, and I'm going to give a brief little biography that he can add to later because there's quite a bit. Andrew Reinhard is an archaeologist with an MA in archaeology and art history, and he's working on a PhD in progress for archaeology with a focus on digital heritage. He's the current director of publications for the American Numismatic Society and writes a popular blog, Archaeogaming. Andrew was the archaeologist for the Atari Game Over documentary, which we'll talk about, and has written extensively on archaeogaming. Andrew is also a co-host of the 8-Bit Test Pit podcast right here on the Archaeology Podcast Network. So, welcome to the Archaeology Show, Andrew.
Hey, thanks very much, Chris, and hello, April. Thanks for having me.
It's always our pleasure.
Awesome. So let's start out, you know, keeping in mind that we aim this show to be towards a general audience that might not know about some of the things that we talk about on some of the other shows, which is why I thought it'd be great to have you on in this format, because I feel like sometimes the 8-Bit Test Pit podcast is also kind of aimed toward an audience that knows about archaeology to begin with, and then we're just bringing in archaeogaming as a topic. And what is archaeogaming for our audience? You know, what does that even mean?
Yeah, archaeogaming, as I define it, and I try to use pretty broad strokes, I basically say that archaeogaming is the archaeology in and of video games. Mm-hmm. So we can take a look at video games as being artifacts. You know, they're part of what we call material culture in the modern age, basically stuff that we use every day. Because the stuff that we use every day and they happen to be video games, they fall under the rubric of archaeogaming. Mm-hmm. And then we take a look at the archaeology inside video games too. So there are a lot of games out there. You can think about Tomb Raider. You can think about Uncharted, the Indiana Jones games, and the like, which basically have an archaeological component to them. You play as an archaeologist or you do archaeology in them. And then going one step beyond, and the thing that really floats my boat, is taking a look at how these games are put together from the inside out, seeing what makes the games work, seeing how games change over time, and treating that in an archaeological way.
Let's start out by doing maybe some, some examples of what you're talking about. You know, something that maybe a popular game, you know, you mentioned Tomb Raider, things like that, but let's dig into it a little deeper and figure out what kind of stuff would you study in that game?
So in any of the Tomb Raider games, you're basically taking a look at old stuff or things that are made to look distressed. You're looking at architecture, you're looking at artifacts. You're basically, in the modern world, looking at these presumably, ancient things, even though these things would have been coded, 3 or 4 years ago. So it's really this kind of interesting split between something that is made today, but made to look really, really old. And so you have that illusion going on. And with the newer games, you're actually dealing with stuff called photogrammetry. That's just a fancy word of saying we are doing scans or super duper photographs of stuff, and we're putting that into the game for the player to interact with, or for the player's avatar, in this case Lara Croft, to act with or act upon. When you're also playing a game like Tomb Raider, you're getting into the field of archaeological ethics in video games, and this is something that Megan Dennis is working on, also at the University of York. where it's like, okay, you have a company like Crystal Dynamics, they're making this game Tomb Raider, and what are they doing in the game that is kind of shady or sketchy, when it comes to raiding tombs or when it comes to taking artifacts? And, you know, for games like Rise of the Tomb Raider, for example, you really don't see the outcome of what it is that you're raiding or what it is that you're doing when you're solving these kinds of puzzles. You might find an artifact, but it doesn't really appear in your inventory. It might appear, you know, as an achievement or a trophy or something like that, and you can kind of spin it around and take a look at it. But you never have the chance to, like, give it to a museum. You never put it in your pocket. You never sell it. And so that was pretty cool. And that did not used to be the case with some of these other games, that you would play. Or, like, if you're playing Uncharted, you're a treasure hunter. Even though you're in antiquity, you're out there for the treasure. You're out there for the goods. And so it's kind of a guilty pleasure to play games like that. But at the same time, you know that in the real world, you're not going to do that. It's like, playing Grand Theft Auto. I'm not going to steal a car. I don't think I'm going to steal a car. But at the same time, it's fun to play and fun to imagine. And so there's kind of this fine line about, what's fun, what gets a little bit uncomfortable, and, how can games kind of communicate things in an archaeological way yet still be entertaining?
And, that's pretty interesting, because we've had discussions on other podcasts recently about how we look at artifacts, how we kind of glorify artifacts. And that's what, your modern, to use a sort of disparaging term, relic hunters, that's what they do. They're out looking for artifacts, and whether they're metal detecting or doing whatever, that's the focus of what they're doing. And I feel like that's always the focus of any game that's that has an archaeological component. It's always about some sort of artifact, and I think the Lara Croft stuff is very similar to that. There might be a bigger story involved, but it's usually involved just like Indiana Jones. It involves some kind of idol or.
And that's the thing. That's the trope, and I think this would have happened even without Steven Spielberg and even without George Lucas Raiders of the Lost Ark coming out in 1982. I really think that this would have happened, because there's always this romantic ideal of the archaeologist, especially, the early 20th century archaeologist as explorer, as adventurer. And back then things were a little bit different. And so, when you're making a game and you want to have an adventure game, an archaeologist is a great character to have, because they have a reason to be in that space. They have a reason to be in the jungle. They have a reason to be in Egypt. And what happens to be in Egypt? Old stuff. And so you can go in and look at old stuff. And what kind of old stuff? Well, artifacts and idols and gold and treasure. And you can go one step further. And I think that pretty much every archaeology game or game that has archaeological relics in it, those relics are either a fabulous wealth, fabulous beauty, or they have really bad magic and consequences if you happen to interact with these things. Yeah. And typically you're either ending the world or fighting ultimate evil, because of these artifacts that you found. And I would really love to see game developers kind of get around that trope and use archaeology and artifacts in a perhaps different way that still contributes to a meaningful narrative or a story.
Yeah, I mean, every other game you see does that. I mean, you brought up Grand Theft Auto. It's been a really long time since I even saw that game. But I can almost guarantee you right now that the major point of that game, like all games, is really more of a quest or a journey. You have to do something in the end, and that's the goal. Whereas with archaeologically themed games, like we said, it's all about the thing, and the thing should really just be a part of the story. And really what you're trying to do is complete this story or help tell this story or do something like that. You can still make that exciting too.
Yeah, you certainly can. And that's not to exclude other kinds of artifacts that you find. I mean, you're going around and you're playing in these, in these spaces that are foreign to you as a player. And you might be in ancient Greece or ancient Rome or in Egypt or someplace else. And, you might be going after this big artifact or this fancy thing. But in order to make the environment realistic, there's all kinds of other stuff that's just strewn around. The graphic designers, the artists who are responsible for the game have also put in broken pots and other kinds of crockery and utensils and tools and all kinds of other things that are just kind of lying around, which make the environment interesting. You can't really interact with these a lot. Depends on the game. But still, you do have that more – common stuff, you know, the coarseware along with the fineware, you know, which is interesting, you know, to me as an archaeologist and to me as a player, it kind of completes that environment. And that's, you know, as a former dirt archaeologist, if I can use the term, we saw a lot more coarseware than we did fineware. You know, we were excavating in Italy or we were excavating in Greece.
I wonder how much of this also comes down to kind of the complicated history of archaeology in museums, where you know, when you're talking about the archaeologist as explorer and going out in the, you know, beginnings of archaeology in the 18, 1900s, you know, we were collecting for museums and for private collections, and we wanted the big, shiny, fancy things. And when people go and see archaeology in a more academic or educational sphere, it's often in the context of museums, where all you see is big, shiny things. And when you're a tourist traveling, you don't go to the tiny house mound, you go to Petra. And you see the most glorious archaeology that you can possibly see. And so that's really what archaeology is in the mind, and the news stories too. You know, everything about archaeology beyond video games really is kind of the glory and fancy stuff that we do.
Yeah, I keep hoping this will change over time. I mean, you certainly, if something fancy gets found, it should be featured because it is part of the assemblage. It's part of the group of objects that have come to light via excavation, along with other kinds of things. The better museums or the better curated exhibitions are ones that integrate those fancier items with everything else to give it context, to give it placement. You know, when you look at this at the old, you know, the old-timey, old-school way of collecting, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. You know, you're going for a private collection. You're on the grand tour and you're picking stuff up for home as souvenirs, or you're collecting for museums. And with that in mind, you know, you're dealing with this kind of colonial worldview too, where it's like, we can take care of this stuff better than they can. You know, what are they doing with this stuff? We should have it because, you know, we're really big into classics or something like that. And I think that's changed over time too. But, you know, when you're dealing with this element within video games, it's still very much that colonial model. You know, you can play some games where that actually comes into question. So The Curious Expedition is a game that comes to mind, where you can take a colonial approach or not. You can interact with non-player characters and other kinds of scenarios in a variety of different ways, so that you can be a 19th century douchebag. I'm sorry, you can bleep that out. Or you can be in there like a social justice kind of person, and deal with things that way, you know. And nice. Within the context of the game, you can actually do both and see what happens. And that's one of the things I really like about doing archaeology in video games, is that I can mess with something. And if something bad happens, or if I break something or whatever, I can always go back to a save point and renew and try it again. And, you know, that's not the luxury that the excavating archaeologist actually has. You break the pot, it's broken. You have to take it to the pot mender. If I break something, I can always go back in the game. And it's brand new, and I can do something else with it.
Andrew, what of all the games that you've seen that have an archaeology theme to them or something like that, can you think of a game that's come as close as possible, or maybe actually achieved this and, like, quote, got it right? Like, you played the game, you looked at it, you said, "Man, these guys did their research, and this is, you know, hitting all the buttons that we like to see." And they just did everything right. Is there a game like that yet, or are there any that are really close?
You know, I've yet to. And you know, there'll be other people out there who are probably like screaming at their at their phones or whatever, saying, "You idiot, you didn't mention this game." to think of a AAA title that fits the bill. It was like, yeah, there's archaeology for you. Okay. You know, I was playing Uncharted 4. I finished it about a month ago. And in it, you know, there's a level, you know, where there's an archaeological excavation set up. And this is pretty early on in the game. And it's abandoned, but it's cool because you can see the tools. You can see, you know, tents and things like that. And it looked pretty authentic. You know, I'm like, okay, that's cool, but you don't really do any archaeology, and you know, all of a sudden you're getting shot at, and so that reverie that you were in looking at this archaeological stuff is over because you're trying to save your hide. There's a game that came out, gosh, it might have been 10 years ago now, from a company called Digit Games, and it's called Romantown. And Romantown was pretty cool because the purpose of the game was to learn about archaeological technique, content, and context as you were excavating a little bit of a town. And so you could move your mouse around on the screen, and you would be digging through different strata. You'd find things, get to put stuff together. And that was cool, too. So, you know, as far as an indie game goes, you know, that game Romantown was pretty cool, but it wasn't pitched as like, you know, amazing entertainment or something. It was there as a fun game that happened to be about archaeology. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's the only one that really came close. And the reason why is that the developer herself was an archaeologist. So, you know, yeah. Yay. But I haven't really seen anything like that since.
Yeah, I've interviewed them at conferences before for Digit Games for a couple of things that they do, and you're right. Yes. Most of their stuff has an educational goal to it, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I don't think in this day and age, I really, God, you know, we talk about this with CRM archaeology, the type of archaeology I do, and you know, we talk about this all the time. Like, yeah. You know, you can make this stuff interesting.
you totally could. I'm just thinking out loud now, because this is a super interesting topic. I hadn't really thought about this before, but you know, if you ever read the book Thieves of Baghdad by Anthony Bogdanos, he was the mm-hmm. the Marine who was really responsible for kind of figuring out how to repatriate all these artifacts that were stolen from the Iraq National Museum, right?
Oh, wow.
From the archaeological museum, and yeah. So. You know, what a great game that would be, where you might mm-hmm. be a cultural attaché embedded with a unit. And I actually have friends who do this. I can't say who they are, but I have friends who do this in Iraq and elsewhere in the Middle East, where that's their job, is to figure out, you know, what's being stolen and where, and how to get stuff back, and what happened, and documentation and stuff. And in the meantime, they have an escort of army dudes, you know. Mm-hmm. And so you've got something like that going on. And then, you know, I could see integrating something into like one of the Call of Duty titles, you know, where you know, you get achievement points or whatnot for, you know, saving the museum, you know, from attack or something like that. So you can certainly, you know, as a developer, kind of work this stuff in. It doesn't have to be the main game mechanic or what you're doing, you know, when you play, but it can mm-hmm. certainly, you know, add that kind of realism, you know, to how cultural heritage is treated and how modern people are, you know, trying to take care of the stuff, especially in areas of conflict.
Right. Well, I want to take it a little bit different direction from this, but still archaeology within games, but in a little different way than people might think, or maybe they are thinking this way, because that's kind of the first thing I thought of, but I'll get into what that means in just a few seconds after the break. Hey, podcast fans, check out the ARC365 podcast at www.arcpodnet.com/ARC365. That's ARCH365 for your daily dose of archaeology. Each episode is less than 15 minutes long, and we have some great guests recording about awesome archaeology. We also try to throw in some definitions and basic archaeological information. So check out the 365 Days of Archaeology podcast only in 2017 at www.arcpodnet.com/ARC365 today. Find us also on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Music by typing ARC365 into the search. Now back to the show.
All right. Well, welcome back. I have one last quick question for Andrew before we move on to Chris's new mysterious topic. So, Andrew, while I've been listening to you, one of the questions that I've just sort of had percolating away is, how did you get into this? I mean, it seems like a really interesting melding of two passions, but I was just really curious, how do you decide that what you are going to do is the archaeology of video games?
Well, okay, I've been, full disclosure, I was born in 1972, and, you know, the first arcade cabinet games were coming out in like 77, 78 in the United States. And so I was able to go to arcades with my dad, and we would play Asteroids. We play Space Invaders, you know, when they first started, you know, showing up, and we started to go to arcades and stuff. I was terrible at these things, but I really liked it. And so, you know, I've been able to grow up kind of in parallel with the history of gaming, you know. So my friends had an Atari 2600s. I had an Intellivision. I had a DOS 386 machine that I would play bootleg games on, like King's Quest, and then we got a Mac, and so I played my first I played my first Infocom game. I played Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and so that was pretty cool. And you know, now, you know, I'm playing these games where it's photorealistic, and there are so many buttons, and everything's really fast, and everything's really gorgeous, and the sound design is amazing, and so, you know, it's just crazy to be able to see all this stuff. And so I think the thing that really kind of flipped the switch, though, as an archaeologist in me, was I started playing World of Warcraft. You know, there it is, the elephant in the room. You know, everybody's like, everybody talks about World of Warcraft. Why is that? And it's like, because it's an amazing game. And I started playing, I don't know, 2009, maybe 2008. You know, so it hadn't been out for too many years, you know, when I first started playing. And I would go, and I was just transfixed by the idea of lore, you know, and I'd be walking around, and there'd be, you know, columns and empty temples and artifacts, and, you know, in later versions of the game, there's actually an archaeology skill that you can do. But for me, it was just saying, wow, I'm in this orc capital called Orgrimmar, or I'm in Thunder Bluff as a Tauren, and I am seeing these distinct cultures and everything from clothing to buildings to the way that the weapons are made, and the fact that you could actually make stuff and trade stuff and everything, you know, plus you had auction houses and everything like that. I'm like, wow, this is amazing. And so the penny really dropped at that point. And then, you know, I started the blog Archaeogaming in 2013. You know, I'd gotten my master's in archaeology back in 96 at the University of Missouri at Columbia, and, you know, had still, you know, kept in touch with archaeology and whatnot, and never really gave it up. And so all of a sudden I'm like, I'm back. And this is why I'm actually doing the PhD now, is because I can't get it out of my head. You know, this keeps me up at night. So, you know, with the blog in 2013, you know, this dovetailed neatly into this bizarre Atari excavation, that was going to be happening. And you know, that might seg into other questions later in the podcast, but everything seemed to come together at once. You know, I'm certainly not the first person to think about archaeology and video games, far from it. You've got people, you know, who, you know, like Ethan Wattrall or Colleen Morgan and those guys, you know, who are working at these things in the early 2000s. You know, I'd been playing around in a virtual space called Second Life, doing Latin and building things in there in a kind of an archaeological way. Yeah, we had a Latin villa back in 2008. We actually had the first, like, international Latin conventiculum, where people from, I think, four different countries came together in that space to talk Latin at each other. Nobody really done that before, so that was really cool. And it started to show me that, yeah, there's a definite link between classics and video games. What about archaeology? What I'm interested in now, though, is how these games are actually archaeological sites as well as artifacts. And we can get into this a little bit later, but taking a look at what I'm calling machine-created culture, where software has been written to make things appear that haven't appeared before in the history of the universe and might not appear again, and what does that mean from an archaeological standpoint?
That's actually a perfect segue, because that's kind of what I wanted to talk about. You know, we've talked about archaeology in video games and represented in video games, but now some of these, like you brought up two of the ones that I wanted to mention, World of Warcraft, which I've never played actually, and Second Life, which I've been in Second Life. And it's, you know, we're really living through history, because, correct me if I'm wrong, but World of Warcraft was one of the first massive worlds where you could go in as a player and just insert yourself into this world. And it's not a world that exists on your machine. It's a world that exists on their servers. So it's, you know, it's something when you make a change, other people will see it. Hey, just like real life. So, I think as we look back on this, you know, history is going to look back on Second Life probably, for different reasons. And then World of Warcraft as, you know, kind of foundational worlds. And if these worlds continue, well, then some of the early things that happened in those worlds, some of the earlier stuff that's still hanging around, the code is still there, and you can still go see or see this. I don't know if you can go to World of Warcraft and see, like, the site of a battle or something somebody built, you know?
Man, this is really – there's so much to talk about with this. It's amazing. With World of Warcraft, I mean, it certainly wasn't the first – MMO. I mean, you can go back to like play things like EverQuest, games like that were coming out in the early thousands. And you can even go back, to the 80s when you have multi-user dungeons or MUDs, where you've got, people interacting on screen, and these are kind of text-based adventures that you're going on with the procedurally generated, caves and monsters and stuff that are happening. When I say procedural generation, it means that there's code in there that makes things appear. If you ever played like real Dungeons and Dragons, I used to play AD&D as a kid. And I really should get back into it. but I should. I mean, everybody should, really. Tabletop games are cool. But with procedural generation, it's kind of like wandering monsters, random encounters where you don't know that something's going to be around the corner, and then you turn and there's a thing, and you've got to kill it, and you've got to roll. And so, you're dealing with that in a text-based adventure, but then later they've actually added visuals to it. That stuff's just incredible. The fact that these worlds do exist and they persist, you've got in World of Warcraft, you have a tale of, I think it was a virus that happened, in the world and made, I'm going to botch this and you'll have to go and fact check me, there was some kind of, fake news. back in the day, and I think this is still in vanilla WoW, they had this virus that basically killed everybody. They have video recordings or something of this. You have the very famous Leroy Jenkins video.
I've heard about that.
A player named Leroy Jenkins who basically, just completely and utterly destroys his group's chances of going into this particular space in the game. And it was so outrageous and so amazing. It was really one of the first viral videos of any kind of MMO gameplay that happened, and the guy's notorious. He like shows up at Comic-Con and stuff and talks to people about this whole thing. This is like world famous because of this event that happened in a video game. Because games like World of Warcraft or WoW for short exist on several different servers, you're basically looking at a multiverse, several different universes operating at the same time. Some things happen in some places and they might not happen in other servers. And so you've got that going on. And you compare that to a game like EVE Online, where that's just one space that's shared by everybody who plays. Mm-hmm. And in there, you've got real world histories, and people are actually writing nonfiction books on the history of EVE and what happened and when and why. You're looking at Archeo gaming in that way, and it's completely rife with things to write about, especially in an academic way.
So, I mean, unlike in the real world, where basically what we're recording is trash, unless you've got some sort of weird preservation, like Pompeii, where it was kind of a catastrophic event that just preserved everything. Mostly what we record 99% of the time, like we said, is trash. It's broken things. It's discarded objects. Now, you have a unique circumstance in a video game online world that would actually make sense from a development standpoint, where code just auto self-destructs. Maybe after it gets too old, like if you've got World of Warcraft running for 20 years, do you want 20-year-old code in there? Because is it just building up and storing in the servers and nobody cares about it? So my question to you is, A, do you know if anybody has built that into their systems where this old stuff just disappears and we'll never see it again, like if it's not used or interacted with in a long time? And B, if that's not the case, then at some point we're going to have to acknowledge that stuff as or those items or those places as historical instances where we really should go record and preserve the fact that they exist, whether it's in the game or just record it some other way and lift that code out and say, here, this was the first, now we have it.
you're speaking my language. This is terrific. Okay. Where to start? There are some games that really learn their lesson quite quickly that if you don't clean up the trash left by players, it's going to crash your servers. And the reason why is that, you have so many players that are playing together in a game. This is specific to MMOs, to massively multiplayer online games, where everybody's looting corpses. Everybody, you know, you kill something and then you strip the bodies of armor and weapons. And sometimes you find things called vendor trash, or you've got really low level items that you just don't need. And so what do? You don't keep them in your inventory. You chuck them on the ground. And so over time, if you weren't thinking ahead as a developer, you're basically looking at all of this trash sitting around, and that takes up memory, that takes up space, and all of a sudden things go wonky. So in a game like World of Warcraft and many, probably I think every other MMO, you know, since then, things just disappear. You log out of the game, you know, you finish your mm-hmm. session for the night or whatever, you come back the next day and stuff is gone. It's like, you know, the street sweeping crew came through and spruced up, you know, Azeroth, and all of a sudden it's just really fresh and shiny and stuff. And so, yeah. You know, you've got that going on too. And it just has a practical thing because it saves space and it saves memory and it keeps things running quickly, because otherwise the computer has to keep track of all of that stuff. And mm-hmm. you know, that takes an awful lot of resources. With these games, you know, I talk about vanilla, you know, for example. So when a game first comes out, that's really the vanilla edition. It hasn't been patched. It hasn't been upgraded. There are no expansion packs for it. It's basically the game on the day of release. And then as things get added on, you know, especially if you're, you know, Blizzard, who creates World of Warcraft, you always want to have new content every year, every couple of years. You always come out with expansion packs and stuff. You lose that original flavor. You lose, you know, that, and people actually, because WoW's been out for so long, you get really nostalgic about that stuff. I remember having to, like, you know, run across, you know, a place called the Barrens, you know, from one place to the other, and it just took mm-hmm. freaking forever. And this is before you could have like flying mounts and things. And so, you know, having that kind of history preserved somewhere is important. Blizzard used to maintain, or someone maintained, you know, apart from Blizzard, an original vanilla WoW server. So if you wanted to log in, you could log in and see what the world used to be like. Blizzard mm-hmm. shut it down for a while. I think they might have either let it come up or they're now maintaining the server themselves. I don't remember. But yeah, that was really important, and people were just super distressed that this one server containing the original version of the game was taken offline and removed from player access. And so people were really down on that. It's like, you know, somebody, you know, like closing the Acropolis of Athens or something. It's like, we can't go there anymore, you know? And so, you know, in that way, that kind of preservation and that kind of access is, I think, to me, super important. And the reason why is that millions of us play these games. We spend so much time in there. We spend so much money. We make things, and not just physical things, but friendships and stuff like that too. And you know, these spaces are as real, you know, to many of us as we're walking around in the real world. There's a scholar named Edward Castronova who does a lot of things about economics and video games and stuff. He just calls it Earth. You have Earth, and then you're playing in the game. And so, you know, there's a lot of crossover, you know, between the two. But yeah, as you play these games, you know, they become as real to you as Earth is. And as such, I think they really deserve a chance to be preserved and protected. And also, if things happen in there that affect so many people, that, you know, they need to have, you know, either monuments or something to remind people about mm-hmm. what took place. Because otherwise, we're just going to lose it all. And that's billions and billions of man hours or people hours that would be ultimately lost. And I think that's immoral.
Yeah, and I feel like part of the ethical conversation that we should be having with these game designers when they have any sort of world or you know, where they're creating an entire universe or at least a land or then they maybe bring in an archaeological or historical component, maybe they don't, but either way, I feel like one of their advisors should be telling them, hey, you know, you guys are creating something that, I don't know, let's be positive here, and maybe it's going to be around for 30 or 40 years. So let's think about that now and think about what you're creating and how many people that's going to impact. It could impact billions of people throughout those decades as they play. I mean, I don't know how many people World of Warcraft has impacted. I was in school with a guy back in college, back in 2004 and 5, and I think World of Warcraft was, I don't know, was it relatively new around then? And He ended up dropping out of college because of World of Warcraft. Now, initially, it was because he stopped going to class, but that, you know, that negative outcome of playing the game too much actually sent his life in another direction, for better or for worse. But that's because of World of Warcraft, and that needs to be acknowledged, you know, historically and culturally.
Yeah. No, I certainly think you're right. And this is something that Castronova gets at. And he was writing about this stuff with EverQuest, which you know, was pre-WoW. And yeah, you know, you have these real these virtual world events and whatnot that do affect your real world. I've known people in the guild I was in who met through the guild and got married. You know, so it has a positive effect too. And then I found others who are totally like blew up their relationship. You know, so you've got that going on as well. But you know, thinking, you know, to just these monster companies like Blizzard, like Activision, where you're putting out these titles, you know they're going to sell, you know people are going to play these for years, possibly decades, then yeah, you know, I'm assuming, and some of the listeners will probably tell me, you know, that I'm correct, that there's going to be an archivist on staff, there's going to be a lore master or somebody who is taking care of these old things. They take care of the original code, and they've got that stored somewhere. They're taking, they have all of the original textures. They have all of the original models of the monsters and stuff. And you know, all of that. I know, for example, like Skywalker Ranch and Lucasfilm. You know, they have archivists that preserve all of the stuff from Star Wars and Indiana Jones and the like, and they just have that in a big archive in a big warehouse somewhere. So yeah, I'm seeing, you know, or hope to see similar things happening with the video game industry, like they've done with the film industry.
You know, God, there's so much more we could talk on this. Like, you're right. It's just like an ending, never ending. Hey, there almost should be an entire podcast about this subject. So, like I said, go over to 8-Bit Testbit Podcast. It's a little bit on hiatus right now because people have lives and work and things, but we're going to be revitalizing it if you want to continue this conversation. But they've got a number of really great episodes over there right now where they talk about all this kind of stuff. So go check that out. We've got one more segment coming on this where we're going to try to tidy this up and not leave you hanging too much with a crazy number of questions, and just send you right over to the 8-Bit Testbit. So we'll be back in just a second to wrap up this conversation with Andrew Reinhard.
All these things we make no apology are the study of archaeology. But we don't do dinosaurs.
Did aliens build Stonehenge? Did the Easter Island statues walk? Did the Vikings colonize Midwest America? What does mainstream archaeology have to say about all of this? Listen to the Archaeological Fantasies podcast and learn about popular archaeological mysteries. Hoax or fact? Learn to tell the difference with Dr. Kenneth Fader and co-host Sarah of the Archie Fantasies blog. Check out the show on iTunes and Stitcher Radio and at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Archie Fantasies and get ready to think critically. Let's get back to the show.
Funny beady blokes, you will see, are a staple of archaeology.
All right, well, welcome back, everyone. So as we've been talking, Andrew, one of the things that I'm just thinking about is all the resurgence, a lot of the computer games that I played as a kid, where in the mid-80s, where we all have a deep nostalgia for them. So, you know, one of my friends just found online this game that I played as a kid called Super Sleuth, where you took photos of robots invading a school and read clues buried in children's homework to discover who the villain was. And so we have these deep memories embedded in video games. So we're sort of bringing them back and making them available through the internet. And, you know, it's really interesting because I can't help but think, are they the real game or are these almost like replicas? And how this fits in. I'm sure you have many thoughts.
No, this is awesome. With what you're saying, I've seen this too, and I've done a bit of work on it. I mean, sometimes I just love games, and I need to go and find them and play. So you can go online and you can type in pretty much any Atari title, and someone has made a Java emulator of that particular game. So for example, I wanted to, for better or worse, play E.T. the Extraterrestrial. And so, you know, I don't have a 2600 at home anymore, and I don't have the cartridges, but I was able to go online and I could play that just on the screen via my web browser. And it had the same music and it was the same stuff. And somebody had just ported it from the cartridge, you know, onto this to this online platform, for better or worse. And you can find a ton of games like that that are old. There's another thing, another term that you can call this, and this doesn't fit with like Atari games and stuff because, you know, those games are you know, awesome and you know, had a long life, but you can go onto sites and find things called abandonware, and you can basically find any game that was published, you know, back in the 1970s, the 1980s, the 1990s, and you can download copies of those games. You know, there are certain copyright issues. You know, some abandonware sites will only have things that are out of copyright, or they can't find the copyright holder, so they'll put them up. Or others will have up all these games until they get a cease and desist letter from the publisher or the rights holder. So, you know, whichever, you know, you're more comfortable with, you can go and you can download these things and you can play them, you can zip them. And this, you know, a lot of times you'll need to have access, you know, for example, to a DOS computer or to an older Macintosh or something like that in order to get these things to work. But still, you can find any game that you want or any game that you've ever played, and you can go and you can find these things and you can play them. And part of this is nostalgia, but part of this is also, you know, going back and actually doing some thorough research, you know. And so you might be doing this on modern hardware. You might have to go and find old hardware in order to get this stuff done. But still, the content is out there and it's available. And it's almost like going into a necropolis and doing an excavation within the necropolis of all of this stuff. And you go and you dig down and you find the stuff and you remember what happened back when. And so this is just happening in real time with more modern material.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely fascinating. I just keep thinking, so I have a museum background, and just the museum and archiving aspects of this, where, you know, there's a big dialogue right now in the museum community about what do we do and how do we handle all of these digital materials? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you archive code? How do you archive video games and the systems needed to run them? And, you know, just sort of dialogues about if you're not playing the game, the Atari game on an Atari, is it really the same thing? You know, is the material object of it part of the experience of that game? And when you divorce the two things, is it really the same game?
Man, this is an excellent question. And this is one of the things, and again, we'll go back to what Megan Dennis is doing in New York. If you read in her Archaeoethics blog, I think this week, you know, she writes about, you know, going and getting old hardware and an old cartridge in order to put them together in order to do her research for her case study. And, you know, there are other people who've been asking the same question too. You know, playing a Sega Saturn game that is not on a Sega Saturn console is different than trying to find your way around that controller, you know, and actually playing it like that. And so you always have this kind of haptic component to gameplay. And when I say that, it basically means it's the physical interacting with the mental and emotional experience of gameplay, where you know, you have to be able to control these things in a certain way in order to make them do it. You know, you can play Rock Band on a computer tapping your keys, but it's totally a different experience than playing Rock Band and you're playing drums or you're playing, you know, the guitar controller that comes with it. So you might get part of the gameplay experience, but you're not going to get the experience where you're actually getting tired. Your arm is getting tired because, you know, you're hitting these notes in rapid succession. And so, playing a game that's not on the original hardware, I think you're definitely losing part of the experience. But again, it depends on what you want to get. If you just want to play the game to play the game to see what the fuss is about, that's one thing. But if you want to play it for some kind of authentic experience, then you're going to need to have the hardware too.
All right. Well, like I said at the end of the last segment, go over to the 8-Bit Test Bit podcast for more of this type of conversation. But for now, on this show, I want to go a slightly different direction, something we talked about, Andrew, yesterday when we were planning for the show. Well, first off, you yourself, you said you're finishing up your PhD at the University of York. I know Megan Dennis and Tara Copplestone, your co-host for 8-Bit Test Pit, are also in schools in the UK. Is there?
Yeah, I mean, they're all at York.
They're all at York. So, So is York just like the Archaeo Gaming mecca, or is there are there any universities in the United States, just so I can understand, that are supporting this effort? Or do you know of anybody in the Archaeo Gaming world that's going to a school in the United States?
Gosh, I don't. And I really wish that wasn't the case. You know, I chose York specifically because Megan was there, Tara was there, and then Sarah Perry, you know, is our mutual advisor. Plus, they have a place called the Center for Digital Heritage. And it's really the only game in town. I mean, they've there are other universities that are doing somewhat similar stuff. I think Southampton in the UK is doing something. But York is really the go-to place for understanding digital heritage, digital material culture, and the like. University of Leiden, at their Department of Archaeology, it's this palace. It's amazing. And they have a, you know, an organization called the Value Project, which is managed by their PhD students. And they're doing a ton of stuff with video game archaeology too. And so, you know, you have this continental European university at Leiden and the UK university at York, you know, working with each other, challenging each other, and really pushing it forward. And I'm not seeing that happening yet in the United States. I don't think there's a single, I don't know if I'm going to get in trouble for this or not. Somebody again, fact check me, but I don't think there's a single department, you know, that or an archaeology department for that matter in the US, you know, that is focusing on digital heritage like York is and like Leiden is. And I wish that would change. You have plenty of other departments like media studies or game studies, even English departments, you know, where you're doing this kind of media archaeology and you can happen to do games, but there's nothing that where games is a focus as digital heritage or as modern material culture, you know, like we've got in Europe.
You know, and I want to shift to the topic that I was intentionally to go to here shortly, but about public funding. But you just made me think of something too, man. I really want to get into some of these worlds and check them out. But like I said, I'm not a gamer, and it's not because I don't want to be. It's just because if I did that, it's all I would do, and then there would be no Archaeology Podcast Network. But, you know, I just, because I know myself and I know who I am. But, and there's another thing too, like a lot of things, you know, it's a little intimidating. It's a little intimidating to just say, oh, I'm going to go get into World of Warcraft and jump into the world there and probably die 5 seconds later. So do you know, or what do you think about this as a concept? Are there any tour guides set up? Like I can go to somebody, like I can go to you, Andrew, and say, okay, meet me here. You guide me through setting up the process, setting up a character, and then meet me somewhere in the world and show me around. Is there anybody doing that yet? Because these worlds are so big and massive.
There are a couple of ways to think about this. First of all, if you Google Value Project in video games, it'll bring you to what's called a Twitch channel. Twitch is a platform for streaming video, and it's sometimes live streamed, so you can watch things as they happen in real time, or they record whatever they're doing and they save that, and you can watch those videos at any time. And so, you know, the Value Project is really good because they go in and they played, for example, a recent game was Horizon Zero Dawn, and they did an archaeological playthrough of that game, Twitch, and you can watch that now, or you could watch it as they were playing, and they would talk about the archaeology of it and what's going on, and they talk about culture and heritage, you know, as they played the game, and that was just really fun to watch. And so if you're looking for these kind of native guides within these games, going to Value Project's Twitch channel, I think is a really good idea. There are, you know, I'm sure that if you, you know, Google Archaeo Gaming, or if you're on social media and you do hashtag Archaeo Gaming, you're going to find the usual suspects, you know, who are doing this stuff right now. We all play, you know, and some of us like MMOs and some of us like standalone games. Some of us play on Steam, which is a PC platform. Others do PlayStation or Xbox games. Some of us do old school retro games, you know, so it depends on what you like. And you can kind of, you know, look through our streams and see if there are things, you know, that kind of float your boat, and then just reach out. You know, the field is so new, or it's still so new, that anybody who expresses interest, we're like, yeah, come on, let's go, let's do it. Just drop us a line, you know, drop me a line, and we will meet you in world. one of the things that I did in World of Warcraft, and this is back in the 2000s, was I had a small guild called Carpe Pridem, which if you speak Latin means seize the booty. Nice. And so this guild was supposed to be, you know, for matching up Latin teachers and Latin students. And a lot of times the students would know the game, but not the language. And the teachers would know the language, but not the game. And so we would go in and we would play together and we would learn the game. Yet at the same time, we would be learning Latin too. And so, you know, it was neat to kind of subvert that space, you know, that play space with some actual, you know, educational content. But at the same time, you know, we had these native tour guides and these Latin speakers, and they were able to work together to get through stuff and to learn the language too. So yeah, it's not a new way of thinking about it, but you know, certainly don't be intimidated. You know, certainly reach out. And, you know, nobody starts off knowing how to play a game as complex as WoW, for example. So it's okay. We will go back and help you, you know, as you gain a foothold in these different spaces. But, you know, that being said, you can do archaeology of solitaire. It's fine and it's real, you know.
Nice. Archaeology of Tetris. That'd be fantastic.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Every video game is archaeological. I'm going to go out and say that right now. I fully believe it. It doesn't have to have a temple in it to be archaeology.
Nice, nice. Well, and that goes for real world archaeology too.
Oh, yeah.
Since we brought up the archaeology of Tetris, can we talk a little bit about the Atari excavation project that we mentioned earlier in the podcast before we have to wrap things up?
Yeah, sure. What do you want to know?
Well, could you just tell our readers or our listeners, you know, I'm going back to a slightly different technology, who might not have heard about this or seen kind of the information. It was a big splash for a while in some of the newspapers, and just kind of tell us a little bit about it and how this project got going. And
yeah, no, you bet. This, okay. So there's this place in the desert of New Mexico, in a little town named Alamogordo, which is really in this epicenter of weirdness, because it's close to Roswell, it's close to the Trinity Missile Test Site, it's close to White Sands, and it happens to be home for, I think, the world's only official video game dump. So this old landfill in Alamogordo was hired by Atari Incorporated back in 1983 to basically allow Atari to dump what was rumored to be probably hundreds of thousands, estimated maybe millions of unsold, unused, and returned copies of the worst video game ever made, and that's in quotes, E.T. the Extraterrestrial. And so, you know, you have this weird story about this clandestine dumping by this multinational corporation of this product that was just rumored to be awful. And this is all happening pre-internet. You know, this happened in 1983. So it happened, and then people forgot about it. Or a lot of people forgot about it. And then the internet happened and people started to come up with these different conspiracy theories. And did they really dump stuff? And they're like, no, that's crazy. Why would they dump stuff? Or if they did dump stuff, was it just ET? Was it other games? Was it really a concrete slab? Is there a curse? And so you had all of this stuff happening. And in 2013, this Canadian entertainment company called Fuel actually successfully negotiated the rights to excavate the Atari dump. They subcontracted this documentary work to Lightbox Studios, which was the entertainment arm, now defunct, of Xbox. And Lightbox Studios hired director Zach Penn, who gets story credit for The Avengers. He's actually the writer of the screenplay for Ready Player One that Steven Spielberg's directing. And he had actually filmed a documentary called Incidents at Loch Ness, which was like this big trolling thing with Werner Herzog. And so, you know, here comes this director guy who's firmly rooted in geek culture, you know, to come out and film the excavation. Now the issue was, they didn't really have any archaeologists, and I don't think they were actually thinking of having archaeologists either. I just happened to write them a note, and I said, hey, I see that you're doing this excavation of the Atari burial ground. I'm writing on video game archaeology. How are you managing the archaeology? And I didn't hear from them for a few months. A few months later, I get a phone call, and it's a guy from Fuel. And he's like, are you the video game archaeology guy? And I'm like, I guess. And they said, well, we were wondering if we were to do an archaeological excavation of video games, how would you do it? Like, are you serious? And so I'm like, well, I don't know. Let me think about this for a minute. And so I hung up with them, and I contacted a couple of people. Actually, I contacted my friend Richard Rothus, who is doing cultural resource management. He does a lot of modern day, you know, excavation, you know, just as part of his job. And so he and I went back and forth on this. We got back to Fuel, and then they put us in touch with Lightbox, and they're like, okay. And they say, well, how long would you need to excavate, you know, say hundreds of thousands of games? And I said, well, if we worked around the clock and we had, you know, help from, you know, local archaeologists and volunteers and stuff, you know, it might take 2 to 3 weeks. And they're like, well, we only have about 2 days to film this. And I'm like, oh God, really? And so they're like, yeah, do you want to come and do it? And I'm like, really? And they're like, yeah. And so they're like, get a team together, and you all can come down, and we'll get it set up. We'll organize this thing. And this is like happening in 2.5 weeks, you know. So how do you plan something that's going to happen in 2.5 weeks? And so that was just crazy, you know, especially for an archaeologist and or even a team of archaeologists to do something like this, working in tandem with the film crew, working in tandem with the city of Alamogordo in order to go in and dig up a bunch of games. That's crazy. So yeah, we all said sure. We volunteered. We drove down. We flew out. And then we did the excavation, and they caught it on film, and it blew up the internet. You know, this is in April 2014 when the excavation's actually going on, and it was just insanity to see global trending on Facebook and Twitter, and my mother, you know, calling me, or I called her from the hotel we were staying, you know, after the excavation. She's like, "Why are you on the front page of the Forbes website?" Like, what? And so I wish this happened for all kinds of archaeology everywhere, you know, because it's not fair, you know, to do something weird. And you know, we were accused of it being a stunt, or that we faked it. And actually, I did a blog post about how we faked the exhibition, you know, the excavation, which people actually believed and had to put in big letters, this is not true. This actually really did happen. I was just trolling you on April Fool's Day. But yeah, I mean, it got the kind of response you would expect from Howard Carter and King Tut's tomb, and that's mm-hmm. ridiculous. But it was so weird because people are thinking about archaeology in a different way now. You know, you can dig up stuff that's not 100 years old, 300 years old, 1,000 years old. It can be 30 years old, and you can dig it up, and it's still archaeology. I'm like, yeah, of course you can. And they're like, you know, cartridges are artifacts? And I'm like, well, yes, they are. You know, so you have that going on. And then as archaeologists, you know, we were really interested to see how things behaved in a landfill. You know, what happens when you bury something in the desert for 35 years? You know, does it decompose or not? Is there other trash in there? And if so, what is it? And do the cartridges still work, you know, if they're buried under there? And this is also, you know, kind of getting into to understanding corporate history, corporate culture, and understanding, you know, the kind of the nascent video game entertainment industry, mm-hmm. you know, how did this contribute or not to the video game crash in the 1980s? And so you've got all of these really interesting questions that are happening too. You know, for most people, they just wanted to see if this stuff was there, you know, but that's the easy question. And for us, there was a lot more to get at.
Nice. Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time on this podcast. However, we do have a couple more questions we want to ask you, Andrew, if you've got the time. And I will just direct people. This is coming out on July 1st, if you're listening to this on the day that it came out, July 1st, 2017, which is also the first day you can sign up for the new Archaeology Podcast membership site, Archaeology Podcast Network membership site, which should have been a promo you heard at the beginning of the show if I did my job right. So head over to archpodnet.com/members, and at the standard member rate, you can get access to extended interviews where I will put up these just a couple more remaining questions that we've got for Andrew. So for the main part of this show, thank you, Andrew. Thank you, April. And definitely check out the 8-Bit Test Pit podcast and check out all the links. I'll try to put as many links as I can in the show notes of all the stuff we talked about, all the different games and things.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem. And thanks for taking your time, Andrew. And We'll talk to you guys next time. And thank you, April's babies, whose names I don't know.
They're really excited about video games.
Oh, yes. I'm sure that they are.
Raise them well.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks, and in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.